This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Welcome to Cabinet. We're very happy you could be here for tonight's event. A book launch for George Pendle's new book, Happy Failure, copies of which are over there. We've been working with George for at least a decade. And he's contributed so many incredible texts to the magazine and to books that we've done. And this book, which has some of the essays from Cabinet and other places, because you do write for other places.
I do.
I'm afraid I'm not pure.
I'm not pure to you. Yeah.
So the book is a fantastic compendium of various essays from the past 10 years or so. I was going to read you a biography from here. There's no biography here, George.
No, sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, sorry. What else? Yeah. You studied the classics?
No.
You studied English.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
So I don't know anything else really. All right. I'm going to hand over to George, and he's going to take us on a little tour through his book, Happy Failure.
Thank you. Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. No, just leave it. I'll do that. Excuse me if I hold this rather close to my face. Welcome. When Brendan Dugan at Karma first suggested I pull together a collection of my essays and journalism from over the past few years, I didn't really think that there was a dominant theme to the subjects I had chosen to write about. It was only after working my way back through the pieces that I really began to find a thematic tone common to all. And so that theme I was somewhat surprised to find was failure. Now, sometimes the pieces I wrote dealt with the subject of failure directly. Sometimes there was little more than a kind of homeopathic sprinkling of failure around. But there was no mistaking the fact that I'm drawn to kind of disappointment and incapacity and to the stories of people whose dreams far outpace their ability to follow them and to arcane ideas that are solely remembered for their staggering impracticality. I mean, take, for example, the spectacular overreaching of the alchemist Johann Conrad Dippel, who spent his whole life failing to turn lead into gold, or the continually unsuccessful attempts of insubstantial micronations like Sealand to gain statehood. Or what about the doomed attempt to jump over a row of double-decker buses on a motorcycle that's too heavy? This last kind of specific failure is what I discuss in the foreword of my book. Evel Knievel is the subject, because there's something about it, something about Evel Knievel, which really seemed to get at the very quintessence of my interest in failure. Sorry. Could everybody turn off their phones, please? That's my daughter, sorry. So I thought I'd read to you the foreword to my book now. It's pretty brief, and it's about Evel Knievel. Evel Knievel. Just saying that name feels like casting a spell. Abracadabra, Evel Knievel! I probably only saw him perform his daredevil stunts 3 or 4 times. But in my memory, whenever I turn on the TV as a young boy, there he is, flying through the air on his motorbike, bedecked in a white jumpsuit trimmed with stars. And yet, whenever I recall him speeding past the crowds, leaping off the rickety wooden ramps, soaring over the double-decker buses, the fountains, the canyons, illuminated in a wash of camera flash, I also see the front wheel of his bike dipping just a little too much, the distance of the landing ramp stretching out in front of him, and then the inevitable plummet to the earth, the bike shattering, the body skidding and tumbling to the ground. Then the long seconds as the doctors rush to him, the agonized clamber onto unsteady legs, the painful wave to the crowd, and the relieved commentator announcing that that was all there was time for today. Another Knievel jump, another Knievel crash. It played out with all the preordained certainty of a Greek tragedy. It was not until Evel Knievel died in 2007, and I read the obituaries, that I discovered quite how inevitable it was. Acquaintances in the daredevil business spoke of how Knievel's bike, a Harley Davidson, was much too heavy for use as a stunt bike. What's more, it had no speedometer, and it had no tachometer either, making it impossible for Knievel to judge his approach speed or revs. Not that having these would have helped much, as Knievel never bothered to research his jumps. There was no calculation of ramp inclines nor trajectory plotting equations. Knievel preferred to jump purely on instinct and feel. Inevitably, these failed him. By the time of his death, the Guinness Book of World Records listed him as having the most bones broken in a lifetime, with an astounding 433. In case you're wondering, there are 206 bones in the adult human body. At times, Evel Knievel could seem like the world's least successful suicide. One jump left him in a coma for a month, but the thrill of watching him was more than just the voyeuristic delight in splintered metal and cracked bone. It was more than just witnessing a man fall. An Evel Knievel jump was the triumph of the unprepared and the insubstantial, of everything that floats, dreams, fancies, caprices, against the gravitating drag, the endless quantifiable verities of the real. It was a case of heroic failure trumping mundane success. Indeed, thinking back on it, it sometimes seems as if Knievel wasn't aiming to land at all. More that he was seeking to reach the zenith of his jump and stay there, caught forever in the freeze frame of the cameras as the title music played and the credits rolled. But the cameras kept rolling, and Knievel kept falling. And every time he jumped, and every time he fell, it made me so goddamn happy. There you go. So, no, please. So what is it about failure that I find compelling? Why am I interested in failure at all? Is it because failure offers a tenuous rebellion against a culture that values success above all else? Or is it just that I take pleasure in the misfortunes of others? Am I a kind of cultural rubbernecker whose gaze is drawn only to the mangled car crash of unfulfilled lives? Or am I an archaeologist excavating unfairly forgotten stories from the tar pit of history? Is there really any difference? After all, aren't archaeologists just rubberneckers who happen to be driving very, very slowly past a car crash that happened thousands of years ago? I don't know. I fail to understand why I'm drawn to these stories of failure. However, I do know that different sorts of failure affect me in different ways. And so I thought I'd try and draw up a kind of simple taxonomy of failure in an attempt to try and tease out the answers to the previous questions. So, this is something else I'm working on. Sorry, there we go. The first category of failure is what I'm terming for this evening the faux failure. This looks like a failure, but actually isn't. And it appears in two slightly different forms. Good examples come from the world of business and the world of art. Now, to take business first, Thomas Edison said it took him 1,000 tries before he developed a successful prototype for the light bulb. When asked how it felt like to fail 1,000 times, he replied, "I didn't. The light bulb was an invention with 1,000 steps." Now, Thomas Edison here transforming failure into a type of incremental success through the power of hindsight. And this has kind of led to an entire branch of self-help and business books with titles such as Fail Fast, Fail Often, How Losing Can Help You Win, The Road to Success is Paved with Failure, and Why Success Always Starts with Failure. The message of these books never varies. Embrace failure if you want to sleep with success. Now, that the business world should be so enamored of failure is unsurprising, as Cabinet so brilliantly revealed in its early... As Cabinet so brilliantly revealed in its early issue themed around failure, the very word failure finds its roots in the 19th century language of credit reporting and specifically bankruptcy. Many economists link the success of America's virile market economy to the constant failure of startups and entrepreneurs. Indeed, this faith in failure leading to success is not just a catchword, but a kind of capitalist catechism. Like Christ, you are told you need to fail, to be crucified by your investors, to be buried behind a boulder of debt before you can rise again, prove your doubt is wrong, and ascend to a financially solvent paradise. And this type of failure is peculiar because it is meant to inspire inspiration and confidence. It often hijacks the words of that irrepressible optimist, Samuel Beckett, who in his late prose poem, Worstwood Ho, wrote, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better." The fact that this quote has become the slogan for the Fail to Succeed Brigade, to be found on mugs, tattoos, and t-shirts, only goes to show how faux this failure really is. For as erstwhile cabinet contributor Ned Bowen, as erstwhile cabinet contributor Ned Bowman remarked, it means something a little darker than just do your best and everything is sure to work out all right in the end. Indeed, Beckett's line refers to the existential failure of all human endeavor, language, communication, everything. You will only ever fail, Beckett says. All will end in woe. So this transformation of Samuel Beckett from bleak existentialist prophet into a kind of motivational life coach is itself a sort of failure of understanding that is remarkable. It's the snatching of success from the very jaws of failure. Now, a different strain of the faux failure exists in the art world. Take John Baldessari's artwork, Wrong, a quintessential disquisition on failure. And Baldessari took a photograph that deliberately broke all the rules of composition laid out in photography textbooks. In particular, the admonition that you should never photograph someone in front of a tree because it looks as though that tree is growing out of their head. Baldessari appropriates the label of failure in order to question the conventions that define success. But the work is not itself a failure. Rather, it's a successful thematization of failure. Failure is paradoxical. You can't seek to attain it, or magically it becomes a certain form of success. Nevertheless, ever since the Salon des Refusés took place in 1863, in which rejected works from the government-sponsored Paris Salon, including paintings by Whistler and Manet, were displayed, the idea of failure has been a rallying cry for artists, despite it being a rebellion that you can never really be a part of. Emile Zola described the paradox in his 1886 novel, The Masterpiece, in which he portrayed artists who had been accepted by the Paris Salon clamoring to be thrown out of the official selection in order to join the failures. So anyway, that's the faux fail. Okay, both inspirational and embraceable. The second form of failure that I want to identify is, by contrast, one that evokes cruelty, the fail or epic fail. Oh, hold on. Let's see. There we go, the fail. Okay, the fail or the epic fail has sprung to prominence over the last few years as an internet meme, although its history stretches from America's funniest home videos all the way back to the gladiatorial contests in ancient Rome, when the emperor's downturned thumb was its gestural equivalent. While the faux fail is perceived as an incremental step on the road to success, the fail is perceived as nothing more than entertainment, a freak show with no educational sustenance to it. We learn from the faux fail while we laugh at the fail. In his book, Crowds and Power, Elias Canetti hypothesized that laughter is a sublimation of our animalistic instincts to kill. For Canetti, a human being who falls down reminds us of an animal we might have hunted and brought down ourselves. Every sudden fall which arouses laughter does so because it suggests helplessness and reminds us that the fallen can, if we want, be treated as prey. Never does this hypothesis seem truer than when it comes to our reaction to the epic fail. We perceive the human being who fails by sticking a lit firework up his bottom, or being punched in the nuts by his toddler, or attempting unsuccessfully to restore an ancient fresco of Jesus in a Spanish church. We perceive these as little more than an animal who has stumbled in the chase. One needs only look at the savagery in the online comments of, say, 13-year-old Rebecca Black's 2011 epic fail of a music video, Friday, to realize how closely linked laughing and eating really are. If we went further and actually ate it, we would not laugh, says Canetti, possibly underestimating the boundaries of the 21st century troll. Instead, we open our mouths, we bare our teeth, and instead of eating poor Miss Black, we laugh. Yet, as the critic Mark O'Connell writes in his superb study of this phenomenon, epic fail, our reaction to this sort of failure is also somewhat neurotic. We laugh because, although we might be frauds, at least we're not as transparently and incompetently fraudulent as they are. At least we haven't stumbled as spectacularly. In short, we laugh because at least we're not prey. Not yet, at least. The identification we make with the failure here does not swell us to compassion and pity. There are no lessons to be learned. The fail is dead meat. Yet the previous two types of failure, the foe and the fail, or the epic fail, don't interest me nearly as much as the third type of failure, the type which produces awe. And this is the type of failure, I would suggest, that is perpetrated by Evel Knievel and most of the denizens of my book. I call this the mystical or happy failure. Oh. Okay. Indeed, the people, this type of failure is not happy because it promotes mirth, but because it provides a unique sort of aesthetic fulfillment that surpasses any effect a success could achieve. Indeed, the people who live out this type of failure would be all the lesser if they were succeeding. Knievel's willful insistence not to prepare for his jumps, not to take the most basic safety precautions, and to keep doing it again and again is a prime example of this mystical failure. It is a sort of Sisyphean stubbornness. Sisyphus, you may recall, was the king of Corinth, who was compelled to an eternity of rolling an immense boulder up a hill, only to watch it roll back down again. An epic fail in the truest meaning of the word here, but actually a mystical fail. But this type of failure is not reserved purely for the spectacular, for the stuntman and for the boulder pushers. Take the hypographic urges of the Reverend Robert Shields, which was also featured in Cabinet magazine. Now, Reverend Robert Shields, who tried to chronicle his entire waking life in 5-minute increments from 1972 until he suffered a stroke in 1997. Shields wrote 37.5 million words of astonishing mundanity, not least because a large proportion of the diary consisted of him recording the actual writing of entries in his diary. So I think you can see here, 4:15 to 4:20, I made handwritten memoranda for the diary. I am behind on typed entries. I just get, in the days before cut and paste, I imagine he wrote that a lot, you know. Anyway, our mouths may hang open when we hear of Shields' insane diary or Knievel's absurd crashes, but it hangs open because not because of Canetti's animalistic kind of urge. Instead, our mouths are agape with a curious mixture of wonder and perhaps fear at the challenge this sort of failure throws up to our success-orientated society. Yes, you've probably got to the bathroom visit by now, I imagine. That's the mystical failure is an effort not only where success is not achieved, but where success is irrelevant to the performative completeness of the act of failing. Knievel and Shields show you that the truism, try and you will succeed, is untrue, for nobody is trying harder than these two. And this type of failure can often be found when people spend years creating impractical inventions or engaging in searches or quests for highly improbable objectives. Take the cryptozoologist's search for imaginary creatures such as Bigfoot or Mothman, or the Lingerie Football League of America's attempt to be a real competitive sporting league. Or this, an apparatus for facilitating the birth of a child by centrifugal force. A design so utterly impractical that it kind of reaches towards the very peaks of sublimity. Yeah. Back and forth. Anyway. In 1898, shortly after completing his great painting, Where Do We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going? Paul Gauguin felt so convinced that the rest of his life would be unsuccessful, he attempted suicide. He was unsuccessful. The mystical or happy failure holds within it a power not too dissimilar from prophecy. Failure is not wished, but we know it's going to happen. And yet the enactment is approached with no diminishment in fervor. Like Wile E. Coyote, forever chasing after the roadrunner without seeming the least bit discouraged. Such perseverance, such stubbornness, reveals a certain greatness of character and makes this type of failure the truest repository of Samuel Beckett's dictum, fail again, fail better. This type of failure showcases the persistence of existence in the face of the inevitable. As I've mentioned earlier, failure is paradoxical. It cannot be sought out. You cannot move towards it. It just happens to you. In that respect, the opposite of failure doesn't seem to be success so much as grace. For just as grace is the free and unmerited favor of God, so failure comes to people who are not seeking it out, but it comes to them as a sort of gift or divine revelation, albeit unwanted. Nevertheless, failure can offer its own sort of salvation. My book shares a title with Herman Melville's short story, The Happy Failure. And in that book, Melville discusses the role that failure, in particular the mystical failure I've just been discussing, may play in shaping a man's life. In the story, the narrator's cantankerous uncle has worked for 10 years on a secretive apparatus that no one knows anything about. The nephew meets his grumbling uncle on the banks of the Hudson River to test it. It turns out to be a scientific device that is meant to convert swamp into fertile fields, and the uncle boasts and brags that it will give him immortal renown. However, despite its complexity and the uncle's raging enthusiasm, it doesn't work. The uncle destroys it in a fit of temper, but then after the destruction, a quiet comes upon him. He no longer shouts at his nephew or berates his manservant. His, quote, his face kindled with a strange, rapt earnestness. As I took my last look at that venerable face, the pale, resigned lips seemed to move. I seemed to hear again his deep, fervent cry, "Praise be to God for the failure." In this story, the uncle is both failure and audience to his own failure. Failure has freed him from the grip of his obsession. Failure has made him happy. So anyway, I thought I would try and read a piece from my book which offers a real-life example of the kind of revelatory failure Melville was writing about. And this excerpt is about William Beckford. And it originally appeared in Cabinet's issue on ruins. Okay, and hopefully we can get through without any more feedback. All right. The Ruined Man. It should come as no surprise that the tower card in the tarot deck, which portrays a stone column being struck by lightning, signifies destruction, loss, and ruin. The fall of a tower, whether in ancient Babylon or modern New York, cannot help but suggest the terrible consequences of hubris. Never has the calamitous obliteration of a grand building been so entwined with one man's fate as in the strange instance of William Beckford and Fonthill Abbey. In 1785, at the tender age of 25, William Beckford, Lord of Fonthill, began the self-imposed exile that was expected of him. On a visit to Powderham Castle the previous year, the married Beckford had dallied with the 17-year-old William Courtney, the future Earl of Devon. The incident had been espied by a servant with calamitous results. Within days, London newspapers were talking of the detestable scene lately acted in Wiltshire by a pair of fashionable male lovers. The scandal blossomed, spurred on by the fact that Beckford was, as Byron would later christen him, England's wealthiest son. See now? Sorry. Born the sole heir to the Lord Mayor of London, Beckford had lived a life of the utmost privilege. At the age of 6, he received music lessons from Mozart, himself aged 9. 4 years later, upon the death of his father, he inherited vast sugar plantations in the West Indies and an annual income of some £100,000 a year. He was tutored in the seclusion of the family home of Fonthill Splendens. But his mind grew enraptured by tales of the East, gleaned from his dead father's library. He dreamed of the gorgeous, the horrible, the absurd, and the magical. And by the age of 12, he was a confirmed Orientalist. Such an interest was not taken to be a suitable pursuit for a future English gentleman. At 13, Beckford's tutor forced him to burn his prized collection of Japanese prints. His family desperately tried to school him to look upon taste and sentiment as acquisitions of less importance than the right use of reason. Sina. They could not have failed more dramatically. Where was I? Sorry, excuse me. As Beckford grew older, his interest in the exotic strengthened, providing an enchanting escape from the English phlegm and frostiness that seemed to nip his enthusiasms in the bud. He began writing magical, romantic stories, and at the age of 21, his head swimming with both the Arabian Nights and the haunting etchings of Giovanni Piranesi, he wrote in 3 days the book on which his reputation rests. Vartek. Vartek is a novel of rebellion. It tells the fate of the Caliph Vatek, ruler of the Arabian Empire, a man obsessed with embracing sensuality and forbidden knowledge. Yet, despite having a giant palace with five wings devoted to the five senses, Vatek remains unfulfilled. Quote, for he wished to know everything. He thus constructs a giant tower, 1,500 steps tall, from which to commune with the stars and penetrate the secrets of heaven. A gross offense against the divine. One day, a mysterious stranger arrives at his court, carrying with him incredible splendors, and offers the caliph access to the palace of subterranean fire, within whose vaults he will be able to contemplate the diadems and inventions of Solomon and the pre-Adamite sultans. Like Faustus before him, Vatek is enamored of such an offer. He renounces Islam, surrenders to the magic arts, and begins a series of human sacrifices to the malignant spirit that tempts him. The laptop has run out of power. Sina, have you paid the electricity bill? I think the power went off.
The power went off?
Yeah. That's Sina, don't worry. Right. Imagine a giant house up here. Okay. So here we go. Vatek eventually travels to a deserted mountain where the earth opens beneath him and he descends into the palace of subterranean fire. The mysterious stranger did not lie. Here are the talismans promised him. But a sense of despair and hatred invests the place. The palace's mournful inhabitants stagger to and fro, their hearts consumed by fire, for Vatek's promised land is nothing other than hell. Now, 4 years after the completion of his great work, Beckford was shunned by society. With his long-suffering but loyal wife in tow, Beckford kicked the dust of England from his heels and began 13 years of peripatetic wandering across Europe. While his fortune could not buy back his shattered reputation, it did make his movements easier. His traveling retinue included a doctor, baker, cook, valet, 3 footmen, and 24 musicians. His bed traveled with him, as did his cutlery, plates, books, and prints. It was reported that he required any inn at which he stopped to have his rooms repapered for him. And on one occasion in Portugal, he was said to have imported a flock of sheep from England to improve the view from his window. He became a rapacious collector, but the death of his wife and the increasingly vociferous European wars drove him back to England's shores in 1796. Still excluded by his peers, Beckford retreated to his estate at Fonthill and directed his ceaseless enthusiasms into creating a concealed kingdom for himself. To keep what he termed unbelievers from intruding upon his fantastical life, he now enclosed the 519 acres of his estate within a 12-foot high wall that stretched for 7 miles. Much to the annoyance of his fox-hunting neighbors, Beckford, unlike most of his class, was a fierce opponent of blood sports. For some years, he had been mulling over plans to construct a little pleasure building on his property, but his vision had grown monstrously since his return. My wife, would you just excuse me for a second? Hello. Hello, dear. What's that? She wants me to... It's past her bedtime. I'm in the middle of it. Sweetie, I'm in the middle. I can't. Okay, look, bring it to the phone. Bring it to the phone. Okay. Okay, hi, sweetie. Hi. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder what you are, up above the starry sky, like an angel in the sky. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. She's gone away from the phone. Well, bring her back, bring her back. What's that? I'm in the middle of the speech. My Bonnie lies over the ocean. My Bonnie lies over the sea. My Bonnie lies over the ocean. So bring back my Bonnie to me. Okay, good night. Good night, sweetie. Sorry, bye. Sorry. Family emergency. I apologize. Family emergency. Right. Where were we? Beckford had just come back from his travels from abroad, and he had begun mulling over plans to construct a little pleasure building on his property, but his vision had grown monstrously since his return. With the fashionable architect James Wyatt in his pay, the proposed Fonthill Abbey was to be a vast Gothic structure in the shape of a cross, with the two axes meeting at a central octagonal building. Almost inevitably, towering over all else, was to be a 300-foot tower, or as Beckford dubbed it, his Grand Babel. When building finally began, Beckford was at the heart of construction. 500 labourers worked in shifts throughout the day and night, and when they were not progressing quickly enough, Beckford bribed 450 more away from the erection of King George III's chapel with large quantities of ale. Beckford could regularly be seen traversing the scaffolding 90 feet in the air, grasping a blazing lamp, quote, shouting, supervising, and singing out of tune. In the middle of a letter to a Swiss friend, he broke off, "Farewell, the octagon is calling me, j'entends sa voix." Within Fonthill, Beckford became Vartek. Even his own daughters took to calling him our caliph, and his fortune allowed his every sensual desire to be fulfilled. He turned the abbey into a cornucopia of fine art and furniture. There were cabinets and boxes of Japanese black and gold lacquer, giant porcelain jars, yellow damask drapes, alabaster tables, ornate oak ceilings, massive marble fireplaces, and 50-foot purple curtains hung behind chairs of purest ebony and ivory. On the walls were Rembrandts, Canalettos, Duras, and Hogarths, and every surface was covered in crystal, amber, and stone curiosities. The handful of guests Beckford allowed to enter his estate were overawed by what they saw. Attendees of a dinner party at which Lord Nelson was present were greeted by Fonthill's resident dwarf, standing by the abbey's 35-foot-tall oak doors, a visual trick employed to accentuate the door's already colossal height. Dinner was served at dusk under the gaze of hooded servants holding flaming torches. Word of the wonders of Fonthill made Beckford an irresistible poison. His neighbours, who still avoided him for his youthful indiscretion, attempted to arrange visits to the abbey when the master of the house was elsewhere. However, if Beckford caught wind of such a visit, he would surprise his ungracious guests with a banquet, which he knew that etiquette, the same etiquette which saw them spurn him, would compel them to attend. Whether it was the bibulous bribes to the abbey's builders or Wyatt's preferred construction materials, cement and timber, no sooner was a wing completed than it began to crumble. On one occasion, Beckford insisted on having Christmas dinner in the abbey, in spite of the fact that the mortar in the kitchen was still wet. As the servants carried the food into the dining room, the kitchen collapsed behind them. The grand tower soon followed, destroyed in a gale, and when the builders ran out of stone during its rebuilding, Beckford demolished his ancestral home of Fonthill Splendens in order to supplement their materials. The more enmeshed Beckford became in his creation, the more isolated he grew. He set man traps in the grounds to ward off trespassers and refused visitors altogether. The construction of the abbey overwhelmed his life. "Some people drink to forget their unhappiness," he wrote. "I do not drink, I build." Indeed, the crumbling of the abbey seemed to excite him, offering as it did the chance to begin building once more. His one complaint the second time the tower fell was that he had not been there to witness it. An innate melancholy infused the building. Its dark and dank rooms spoke of a grandiloquence underscored by loss, of majesty exiled. Even the wonders of the abbey's scale were undercut by something infinitely sad. The painter constable thought it, quote, "strange that such a place, so fairy-like and so filling by every standard a role of taste and elegance, should be standing alone in these melancholy regions of the Wiltshire Downs." The same could be said of Beckford himself. By 1817, it was rumoured that he was enlivening his solitary existence by ordering lavish meals for 12, at which he would be the sole guest. With 12 servants attending to his needs, he would eat just one dish before leaving the table. In gloom and isolation he lived, his only companions his four dogs, nephew, Tring, Mrs. Fry, and Viscount Fartlebury. Beckford felt compelled to continue stocking his house with new treasures and to keep rebuilding. Rooms were constantly redesignated and redecorated. Like Vartek's palace of subterranean fire, the abbey had become both the prize Beckford sought and his eternal punishment. He was trapped in a fairy tale of his own creation. However, Beckford was not as blind to his fate as the Caliph Vartek had been. Entombed alive in his crumbling monster, he wrote to his son-in-law, I will die if I vegetate here many more months in this state of solitary abandonment. As his sugar plantation suffered major reversals, he desperately tried to sell the abbey, but each attempt was aborted. I am suspended between the sky and the earth, he wrote to one prospective buyer, his words infused with genuine dread. I implore you to release me from this insupportable position. In 1822, a buyer was finally found, and as if by magic, Beckford was released from the curse of Fonthill Abbey. I am rid of the Holy Sepulchre, he wrote, as if awakening from a nightmare. Not for 20 years have I found myself so rich, so independent, so tranquil. When the tower at Fonthill collapsed for the third and final time in December 1825, destroying much of the abbey, Beckford seemed to have escaped the fate that had been destined for him. Would to God it had been more substantially built, wrote one contemporary architect who visited the site. But as it is, the ruins will tell a tale of wonder. So that... Thank you. So that's the tale of... That's a tale of Beckford, who I see as kind of embodying this kind of mystical or happy failure. Not a happiness which makes you laugh, but something else, something which really kind of just makes you just amazed. And in summation, I kind of want to contend that failure is really not given its due credit. In fact, failure is incredibly important. Our days are made of it. We fail to wake up on time. We fail to pour the right amount of milk into our coffee. We fail to throw the piece of paper into the trash can. You know, in many respects, we live to fail. And as I hope I've shown this evening, I think sometimes failing can show us how to live. I don't know, for those of you who travel, you may be familiar with the Sky Mall catalogue. Nina, I think, I definitely know you are. But it's a kind of repository for failure. It's full of ridiculous items which nobody would ever want. But in there is a box for sale that, when opened, provides a round of applause. I think a more fitting item would be a box that does not applaud when you open it, that simply sits there, open-mouthed, looking at you, in awe. That's it. I'm sorry, would you mind if I just went to the bathroom very quickly before I... Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'll be right back. Oh, it's right there. Okay. Oh, sorry. Do you mind? Sorry. Very quick. Sorry.
Oh. Let's just have a little drop for Daddy. A little drop.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I
don't know if there are any... Lexi?
I don't know if there are any questions. if there aren't, we can have drinks, but maybe if there are questions about the three types of failure, right? Two types.
Three
types of failure. Any questions? Comments?
Thoughts? Feelings?
No? None?
What's he doing here?
So sweet, I play so good, and you get
It's nice, but, you know, we were trying to do a reading here.
What? What's going on?
That's the people upstairs. They have a little music studio.
Is there... Well... would anybody have anything else to say? Any questions? Okay. Yes. I think maybe we'll just wrap it up. Thank you. Thank you, Cabinet. Thank you.